This is Wine, Women, and Revolution with your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. Hi, and welcome to Wine, Women, and Revolution. I'm your host, Heather Warburton, coming at you here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. You can find us online at www.njrevolutionradio.com. Make sure you reach out to us on social media. We're on Facebook, Twitter. We really appreciate it when you like and share all of our stuff and help us grow this anti-capitalist activist network news that you never hear anywhere else, thing that we're trying to build here. Today, I'm going to be delving into an issue. Now, I don't want you to turn off the radio. I know this can be very complicated, and some people may have a gut-wrenching reaction that they don't like, but we're going to be just talking about modern monetary theory a little bit. But I have got one of the smartest and most intelligent men that I've ever met, Mike Merrill, who's a professor he's the director of the Rutgers Learn program. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Hi, Heather. Glad to be here.
So can you tell me first a little bit about what Rutgers Learn is?
Rutgers Learn is the extension division of the Department of Labor Studies and Employment Relations at the School for Management and Labor Relations. It's a mouthful. But basically, we are the program has extension programming at the School for Management Labor Relations has been in place for more than 50 years, providing trade union professionals, labor movement activists, interested employers, and the general public with educational programs about how can we best organize our workplaces so that they, you know, work well for all concerned, that everybody gets a living wage, they are treated fairly at work, their employers can make whatever they need in order to stay in business, etc.
And you're focusing also a bit more on some of the wider just social justice aspects as well as not just labor history and things like that.
Yes, well, labor education generally has focused on the nuts and bolts of labor management relations. So a lot of collective bargaining, a lot of dispute resolution, etc. But it is a subset of a wider tradition, workers' education, which has always been concerned with trying to understand how the world works to make it a better place for working people as well as for the money. And I think I can say that on Revolutionary Radio without too much problem. So
No, I don't think anything you say will be too revolutionary for the audience today.
So that's, we can't actually change the workplace or make the workplace work if we don't change the broader society or make the broader society work in ways that feed those positive developments. If we're going to have shared prosperity, we can't have shared prosperity in one workplace. We're going to have shared prosperity across the whole society.
So I came in contact with you when I was going through the training for the income inequality Leslie Uphold classes when I got certified to be a trainer there. And you actually led a little mini class that I was a part of the Citizen's Guide for a Fair Economy, I think is what it was called. And you kind of taught us all a little bit about MMT and just a lot about different economies. And it was a really fascinating little class you taught. And coming out of that, I wanted to first ask you, you know, here on New Jersey Revolution Radio, we are an anti-capitalist radio station, and you have some opinions about capitalism that I'd like you to share.
Well, yes. I mean, my own dissertation research, for 50 years, I've been studying the transition to capitalism in the United States. And when I started, it was something of a controversial topic because the conventional wisdom was that capitalism came in the first ships. That was a famous phrase, that there was no real alternative to a capitalist way of life in the United States unless you count slavery. And there was a big controversy over whether slavery was capitalist or not, which, I mean, I think it was, but it also had distinctive elements. So, you know, we don't need to go into that at the moment. But the point is that the question has always been, so what's the alternative to capitalism? Part of the problem I have with that way of asking the question is that we first have to define capitalism. And I think the traditional definition of capitalism, the way it's used, is to be synonymous with the market economy in general. So capitalism, when we say capitalism, most people mean, well, the market economy. You know, if we don't have capitalism, we don't have markets. You know, it's just, it's terrible. is the assumption. And actually, I've studied the history of the term, and the capitalism has not always referred to the market economy in general. It's actually referred to a particular form of market economy, namely one run by capitalists. You can have market economies that capitalists don't run. They can be run by workers, they can be run by consumers, they can be run by farmers and landlords, whatever. There's various forms of market economy. And by assuming that the only form of market economy that can exist and has to exist is one dominated by capital or the moneyed, closes off our alternatives. So I was looking at the history of this, and I mean, I think for me, the market economy in the early United States was dominated by landholders. There were large landholders in the South, slave owners, who dominated the Southern market economy, but there were small-holding farmers in the North who tended to be the dominant social force in the North. And that, to me, was the social basis of what we call American democracy, and whatever its virtues were rooted in that social base. And if you read Alex de Tocqueville's famous Democracy in America, he talks endlessly about all of the ways in which equality was the principal theme, without neglecting the slave dimension or even gender and sex relations. I mean, it's all in there in some ways, but it's a totally different world than the world we live in now. And I've tried to understand how we got from there to here. And the main question around that is, how did capitalists take charge to the exclusion of every other interest in society?
And one thing that you had said that I thought was quite brilliant was that capitalism requires infinite growth on a finite planet. Do you want to expand a bit about that?
Capitalism is essentially, when market economies are dominated by capital, their principal goal is to maximize their profits. That's what capital does, and it tries to. But it is a zero-sum solution. It's got to shit. You know, there's only so much wealth that's generated in any particular enterprise, and the question is, how much share does each party to this enterprise get? And there are contending claims, right? There's investors, there's the actual managers themselves, there's the wage earners. Consumers also have a stake in this in terms of how much can they pay for the final product. So there's different parties contesting with each other about how you divide up the total wealth that's generated, who gets what share of it. I think that then what happens is that when workers are powerful enough to insist on high wages, or consumers are powerful enough and there's enough competition in the system to force prices to stay relatively affordable, then capitalists have to fight back. You know, they have to find ways of increasing their own leverage and power. And that's a very tense social contradiction, and it's produced the what we know of as the labor conflicts in the United States for 200 years and as well as elsewhere. The solution that there's two solutions to that. One is the capitalists could accept less, and the other is they could say we'll keep growing. We'll just make it bigger. We'll make the pie bigger and bigger. And then no matter how big our share is, you'll still get a piece that's adequate. So this idea of infinite growth came as a solution to the social contradiction between capital and labor. It was a way of evading, actually, or trying to avoid the conflict. Buying people off by saying, let us get as filthy rich as we have to or want to, and we'll give you enough to live on so you won't have anything to complain. The thing that's tricky about all of this is that I think this is an argument that most people buy, you know, that they say the only way we can have adequate growth is if capitalists make lots of money. So growth has become the solution to all our social ills almost across the spectrum, whether you're a worker, a consumer, an investor, you say growth is the answer to everything. And what
that's... Yeah, absolutely. You hear that everywhere.
Belling the cat. That's not belling the cat, which is the inequality of power between capital, labor, and consumers. That our real challenge is how do we... the way I put it, actually, is that people think that the biggest problem we face is how do we redistribute wealth. And I say the redistribution of wealth will take care of itself once we figure out how to redistribute power. That's what we need to be talking about.
And that's very interesting because, you know, the capitalist class controls everything now. And we're all sort of stuck competing with each other for a not unlimited supply of jobs. That we're forced to compete with other workers for the scraps that the capitalist class allow us to have. And you're thinking of something totally different as your solutions that you have in mind, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, the way I like to, picking up on your theme here, I mean, I used to run a program for trade unionists in New York. It was a college program for electricians, IBEW, Local 3 Electricians, plumbers and pipe fitters in Local 1, they would take a college course at Empire State College. And when the students would come the first day, I would ask them they would always want to know, why do you go to college? You know? And I said, look, the reason you're going to college is because right now society is organized like a game of musical chairs. And there are not enough chairs. Some people actually have reserved seats. They get to watch the rest of us scramble for the seats that are left. And not only are there not enough seats, there's deliberately not enough seats. We've organized society so that, I mean, I think we say, the economists say that the natural rate of unemployment is 5%. That means that one out of every 20 people and all of their family members are going to be without a job at any point in time. And that, to me, is unacceptable.
And that's how the system is designed. That's considered a functional system, is to have 5% unemployment, correct?
Yes, that's considered good. That's considered the best we can do. And the people who pay the price for that are the ones who have the least resources, who have the most need for work, and who are then desperate to hang on to any job they have in order to have something. And are engaged in this competition back and forth with those who don't have it. And I think it works all the way up the chain. In other words, if you have a very good job, if you're a professional, most people don't have the chance to walk away from a bad job anytime they want. They have to try to figure out how to solve the problem and what leverage you have. Well, unions give you some leverage. That's one point. It's called voice at work. But actually, I don't think our voices at work are effective if we don't have a choice at work. The most extreme choice, of course, is a strike. You know, you say, look, we're going to refuse to work. But throughout history, workers have had the most power when they've not only had an organized voice at work and the right to strike in extreme situations when push really came to shove, but also in between when they had the choice to leave if it wasn't working for them, and work for somebody who offered them a better deal. In theory, that's the way the economy, the market economy, that's what the economists say is supposed to be true. But in practice, all of us know that the bosses have a lot more choice about workers than workers have about bosses.
Oh, absolutely. And I think it's getting more and more delineated all the time that people are just forcing to compete for lower and lower and lower wages. And the gig economy is definitely a part of that, where you have no representation and no worker alliances whatsoever.
Two research papers just came across my desk earlier this summer that I'll mention briefly. One is from the Economic Policy Institute, and it's a short summary of a dissertation done by a French researcher under the supervision of Thomas Piketty and Emmanuel Saez. Piketty's famous for his Capital in the 21st Century book 4 or 5 years ago. This dissertation student looked at distribution of income in the United States by regions. And where has new wealth or new income gone? Which segment of the income classes has it gone to? And between 1948 and 1973, the top 1% of the income group in the United States received about 10% of the growth in income in those 25 years. That's obviously greater than its proportionate share, but that's what happens when you're rich. You get a little bit richer. But if you look what's happened since 1973, the proportion of the new wealth that's gone to the top 1% is more like 60%, which is an astonishing discontinuous break. And it's a index of how much power the moneyed classes now have compared to what they had at the end of World War II, to your point. The second research paper is from the Urban Institute. It was just released last week, and it was a survey, 7,000 surveys, questions across the country, asking people, have you suffered a material need in the last year, in 2017, in terms of housing, food, healthcare, basic necessities? Were you actually desperate and actually deprived of basic necessity in some respect in one of these five areas? I don't need to go into all the details, but the Urban Institute has it if you go to their website. And they found, and this is astonishing, I think, though not surprising, 40% of the American people suffered some material need in 2017. 40% of the richest country in the United States can't meet basic necessities. Something's wrong with the way we organize things. If all the wealth is going to the wealthiest, and an almost majority of the population can't meet basic needs, it's a sick situation.
Right, and these are basic necessities we're talking about. Yes. But meanwhile, we have a car in space.
Food, clothing, basic necessities.
So this is where the theory of modern monetary theory comes into play a little bit. Can you give us the not-so-scholarly, just the layman's rundown of what this new theory says?
The first point is, of course, that when modern money theory is contrasted initially with traditional money theory, in other words, there is a traditional way of looking at money and how what it's for and where it comes from. That's traditional. What's modern about modern money theory is that it's rejecting the traditional view. So the best way to understand modern money theory, I think, is first to start with the traditional view. The traditional view is that money, I think many people, I thought about this, I was always puzzled. How does a paper dollar have any value? The traditional theory of money is that money is actually produced by markets. It's a commodity. So it's gold or it's something like this. And that's it's an item of value that happens to have characteristics that make it easy to use. Cowrie shells are money, gold coins are money, these things that get printed, and so we think of money as some kind of store of value. There are the traditional meanings of money, that it's a standard of price, a means of exchange, and a store of value. You can keep it, put it on your shelf, it'll still have its value when it's done. Well, the idea here is, and also it's also called the commodity theory of money. And if you read Marx, he has a commodity theory of money. If you read Adam Smith, he has a commodity theory of money. This is the traditional theory of money. About sometime at the end of the 19th century, early 20th century, as people began to try to think about why is most money paper rather than a physical object, that's when modern money theory first emerged. And I think here it's important to note that actually paper money is a relatively recent phenomenon. We haven't had reliable paper money, that is paper money that actually gets used and doesn't produce massive inflations immediately, only for a couple hundred years. Many people tried to have paper money before the end of the 18th, early 19th century, but they failed. But by the end of the 19th, early 20th century, paper money regimes were common. So it was trying to understand why paper money actually worked, that modern money theory emerged. And before there was paper money theory, it made sense to have a commodity theory, because most money seemed to be commodity, or a stamped piece of metal, or some, you know, a tobacco leaf or a cowrie shell, etc. Paper money didn't seem to work. Well, so now when we get to the 20th century, we ask ourselves, why does paper money work? This is where modern money theory comes in. And my own view is that you need to also now distinguish between two different kinds of paper money, because banks can also produce paper money. Deposit banking began at the end of the 19th century. People gave they used bankers to pay their bills, and when bankers began to be used and banks began to be used to pay people's bills in a general way, it enabled the bankers to issue notes that people would accept as currency, because they knew the bank would accept it in payment, whether, you know, as a way of dealing with the debts that their depositors had or their creditors had, that they have this whole thing. And we tend to think, I think most people accept the existence of paper money, but they think of it as bank money, and that bankers are the people who create money. And so here's where we get to the really, to me, the exciting part, if you will, if you're excited about economics. My wife usually goes to sleep when I start talking economics, but the part here is that we need to. I have to talk about taxes to talk, because the other feature of modern money theory is that banks are not the only institutions in society that can create paper money. In fact, they're not the best institutions to create paper money. When you only have banks creating money, they tend to skimp on it. It's in short supply. It serves the interests of bondholders and creditors, not of workers and spenders, even investors, because if you have too much paper money, unless you have an unlimited well of credit and goodwill, you can easily have a run on the bank and your business can collapse. And we're familiar with the ups and downs people have heard, at least, and we're becoming more and more familiar with the ups and downs of financial crises. Those are when banks run things. The alternative to private money, bank paper money, is public money. And this is the modern money theory in particular refers to this piece of the equation. People began to point out in the early 20th century that actually money is created by governments, not by banks. Banks are often given the license to manage that money, but unless the government creates the money, the monetary system is unstable. Nobody really knows what it's worth, because how many banks are you actually familiar with? How many bankers can you trust?
Right.
Throughout the 19th century, different kinds of banks issued their own notes. They were discounted in various ways. Herman Melville's Confidence Man is a famous fictional treatment of the confusion that monetary systems introduced when they were bank-based. Modern money theory says that actually the best money is created by governments, and that the best paper money is paper money guaranteed by governments.
Right. When you look on a dollar bill, it says this is backed, yes, by the full faith and credit of the U.S. government.
It's legal tender in the United States. And so this actually changes everything if you think through the implications. The first thing that it changes is that the first thing we have to get our head around is we think that we pay taxes to the federal government so that the federal government has money. But actually, we pay taxes to the federal government so that we have money. The federal government prints money.
Right, so they already have it.
It whenever it has a need, it writes a check. It doesn't wait for taxes to come in order to pay its bills. The function of taxes is to make sure that the money is worth something. But it can print all the money it wants. It doesn't have to wait for the taxes to come. And, you know, we see this all the time. If there's an emergency, natural disaster, we decide to go to war for good reasons or bad reasons, there's always money because they just write the checks. That's all it takes. But we don't wait for the taxes to come in order for there to be money. So we have to, it suddenly means that actually, money is not in short supply. It's not as the bankers tell us, well, there's only so much, and you have to follow my rules if you want it, which is otherwise known as austerity. You don't need to organize your monetary system on an austerity basis. You need to organize your monetary system on a shared prosperity basis, and then you have all the money you need to employ people in useful services, whether in the public sector or the private sector. And to me, that's the most important part about modern money theory, is that it suggests this notion that money is in scarcity. And we always have to, I mean, there are limits. I don't want to make this sound like, you know, it's like there's no limits at all, that you can do whatever you want. You have to invest reasonably. But if you invest in services that people want, so that they will pay taxes to support them, the money, the enterprise will pay for itself. And we need to think about this and get our heads around this in ways so that we don't feel so trapped by the money. They actually are dependent upon us for their money. They just like us to think that we're dependent on them. I don't know if that makes any sense.
No, that definitely, that so much you think of, oh, well, it's the, you know, this top down, but really value comes from labor, for one thing. And also just, I'm trying to think of an easy way to explain it for the listeners, and you can confirm possibly or deny or expand upon, that the government creates the money. If they took back all of that money, none of us would have money. We are paying back taxes to show we support what the government's doing.
There are various instances recently where governments have tried to change the currency. You know, both in India, there's a famous they redid all the banknotes to a great deal of consternation. And Venezuela, they're trying to refund the currency because everything has gone completely haywire there, and nobody trusts anybody, and so it's not working. And you could create massive chaos if you decided to try to redo the currency. The best way to eliminate a currency is to not tax enough to fund it. I mean, for example, the debt ceiling that the Republicans were playing with for a few years under Obama was, I think, finally some people with money took them aside and told them that they were actually endangering all of their wealth, not just the wealth of, the people they wanted to attack. That they will bring down the entire monetary system if they create a circumstance where the good faith and credit of the United States is no longer valued. The hyperinflation circumstances, like in Venezuela, are not not a function of too much money. They're a function of too little taxes. And that's another way of thinking about what are the limits. I mean, you can't have a money supply that is too big for the tax base, for what the tax base will support. So, if you say to people, look, would you be willing to raise your taxes if your income went up more than your taxes, so that you would actually be better off when you were done. I think most people would agree that higher taxes are not the problem. It's low wages that are the problem.
Right, exactly.
So if you raise wages, if you raise taxes as a way of raising wages and it actually works, but, you know, that takes, it's an act of faith there, obviously. And the high wages have to come before the high taxes to actually work. But you create a virtuous cycle by increasing workers' power, raising wages, and you can run the government on a deficit, as it does all the time, in order to create a high-wage regime, as long as you bring the high taxes into the equation soon enough to support the effort. So it's not a magic bullet in the sense that, you know, it's not a Hogwarts chant where everything will change just by saying the right words.
Right, but we can't just plop it down in the system we have where the capitalist class has all the power, because then anything we printed would still just go to the capitalist class. We have to raise worker power as a way of stabilizing this new influx of money.
Well, the most important power we have with respect to this is democracy, in my view. The reason why the moneyed classes have always been suspicious of democracy, and they've expressed this suspicion for centuries, is that as soon as you have democracy, then the poor people are going to vote and take away our money. And we can't have that, because if you take away our money, well, one, it's our money, and number two, everything will go to pot. You know, we'll have nothing but poverty everywhere. It's obviously not true that high taxes are associated with low wages and impoverished situations, because the taxes in social democratic Europe are twice as high as they are in Europe, and their wages are high. They have different institutions. Let's hope they can keep them. But it's not the case that high taxes mean poverty. What means poverty is unequal power. When workers and consumers don't have power, then prosperity is distributed in uneven, in fact, unfair ways. When they do have power, prosperity can be distributed more evenly and more fairly. That's the source of our power, figuring out how to organize society so that workers have choices, consumers have choices. I'm fine with investors having choices too, but they shouldn't have all the choices.
So where that comes in, back, if we go back to the earlier part of the conversation where we were talking about that good 5% unemployment that's currently the system, if we had a federal jobs guarantee, that could eliminate that. Well, we've got to keep this amount of population unemployed so they can compete for each other for the lowest, right, you know, lowest wages.
Yes. My short definition, I have two definitions of capitalism that I use in teaching. One is that capitalism is a market economy run by and for the, by or in the interests of the capitalist or moneyed classes. You can have market economies that are run by or in the interests of other classes, and I wouldn't call that capitalism, you know, but that's an esoteric point. But if you then look at it, it seems to me the most important feature of capitalism, I would call job blackmail and wage extortion. That capitalism, the capitalist class, can ensure maximum profit through job blackmail. It makes sure that everybody is grateful for the job they have. They don't have an alternative, so that they will accept whatever deal they're given. Some people have more options than others, but I don't think it's intentional necessarily. Some people, you know, maybe they're evil enough to do this intentionally, but I think basically capitalists understand that they, to be competitive, they need, they need to be able to drive a hard bargain. So they like circumstances that enable them to drive a hard bargain, and they don't think about the consequences. They just think about the benefits to themselves. This is human nature in some ways. But the job blackmail enables the capitalists to drive a hard bargain. Management by stress, get rid of people, you know, not worrying about everything. And we have this, it also is the basis for their wage extortion. It's the reason why profits are so abnormally high. I believe that profit is a perfectly legitimate payment to a factor. I mean, I don't think all profit should be abolished. I personally don't believe that profit should not exist at all. But I believe that all income, whether it's profit or wages, is rent. In other words, it's all comes to you by virtue of your strategic location. How much leverage do you have? What is your place? Location, 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 except it's social location, social location, social location. If you're a moneyed person, you have lots of social leverage. You can maximize your profits. Workers used to have more social location leverage when they had unions, when they had choice. We need to organize society so that everybody has adequate leverage to ensure a fair wage. And a guaranteed employment is, I think, with a living wage, is the best way to do that. And I think we can do that if we understand that the public sector is not a drain on the private sector, that taxes don't make us poorer, taxes can make us richer. If we actually run our public sector in ways that are meant to enhance the welfare of all, rather than just ensure the transfer of wealth to the few.
I think, you know, obviously my audience knows that I do not like the idea of profit, and I think that all the means of production should be nationalized and held by the people. But why I really like to talk about this is it really can open people's eyes up to how the economy we have is not remotely the only kind of economy that exists. This economy you're talking about could be an excellent stepping point on the way to some other economy. But if you never open your eyes and start looking at differing kinds of economies, whether they still have profit or not, then you can never change. So I think this is an amazing, like, and I think a lot of people, that's almost why some people have a cultish following of MMT, is that it really does open your eyes that, wow, we can design a much different society if we think about things just a tiny bit different.
Yes. I mean, we can use, democracy is not just formal rights to vote on the people who get to tell us what to do. It also has a substantive dimension. And the democratic state, in my view, is a completely different animal from the older absolutist or monarchical states, which were extractive. The democratic state can be productive. It can create wealth, not just take wealth. That's different in the history of humanity. It has to be a democratic state in order to work. That is, it has to serve the interests of all. And as soon as it does, and if all participate in its management, you can create a virtuous circle. And there are instances, as you've pointed out, around the world today where that virtuous circle has been created. It's currently under a lot of stress. And whether we can save this virtuous circle in our generation, I think, is the most important question we face. And the environmental crisis is the front line of that question. Because the Mother Earth is not going to let us keep our rooms so dirty for much longer.
Right. We're definitely on the, if not, I think actually we're probably a little bit beyond the brink, but we're definitely well in the start of total climate catastrophe and massive inequality. And we just, you know, even just the UN recently released a statement that capitalism is not going to be sustainable in the long run. No. So we have to think about ways of drastically changing things. Yes. And so MMT is one of those things. Would it be my end goal? No. But is it an absolute step in the right direction? 100%. Because, yes. You know, it's very freeing to people to start thinking like, okay, there can be something different.
Yes. And I think the one line summary I would make about its contribution is that there is enough money to do what we want to do. Money is not the problem. It's agreeing on what we should do, that's the problem. And as long as we think that our only solution is a competitive system where it's winner take all, or most goes to the few, and everything is a game of musical chairs, we're going to be in this problem. We need to agree that we want shared prosperity. We want security and freedom for all, not just for, a few. And then there's going to be enough money to do that if we make that decision. That's, money is not the problem. We're the problem.
Right. And, you know, some will argue that, you know, oh, well, it's human nature to be greedy, and which I would definitely suggest people read some, like, Kropotkin, or some of the social, or the ANCOMs, you know, especially like mutual aid, that we've actually evolved to be cooperative. So if we work together, we can design something good. And that's kind of how we evolved.
Yes. Well, I would also recommend in E.O. Wilson's The Social Conquest of the Earth, about the ways in which humanity's evolutionary success is related to what he calls its eusocial character, that it actually is dependent upon the way it organizes and cooperates with each other. And it's it builds upon Kropotkin's insights in mutual aid and that of these earlier evolutionary theorists, but he's does it from this other base. It's a fascinating book, and it's totally consistent with this perspective you're talking about.
Yeah, I'll have to check that one out. I haven't read that one yet, but thank you. I'll definitely check that one out as well. And hopefully, my listeners, you've gotten a lot of book recommendations this episode, so I'm going to have to start keeping a reading list, I think, going for the Wine, Women, and Revolution podcast. But it's been a great conversation with you. I've really enjoyed it. Do you have any last words you'd like to add?
Well, I hope to be able to contribute to the conversation. I'm going to start a sort of a learning platform at Learn in the next month or so. It's called Our Best New Jersey. And the goal is to provide a place where we can share these resources, discuss these ideas, and move forward to try to figure out what we want. And maybe once I get it going, I can come back and talk to you some more about it.
Oh, absolutely. You're welcome back anytime. And if you want to get me any links to anything, I can put them in the show notes so people can find what you're doing. And, if they want to have these interesting conversations with you.
Will do.
All right. Thank you again so much for being here. It's really a pleasure to talk to you and catch up with you again. And to my listeners, thank you so much for listening. And we need your help here on New Jersey Revolution Radio. We do not take any corporate money. We do not support the capitalists. So, it's harder to make ends meet here. So we definitely rely on donations from our listeners. You can go onto our website, www.njrevolutionradio.com. Click on that donate button. You can help us out on Patreon and become a monthly subscriber. That really helps us know what we have from month to month. It costs us about $25 a week to keep the network going. And you guys have been great stepping up, and we really appreciate it. Every little bit helps. Thank you so much for joining us. The future is yours to create. Go out there and create it.